This I don't know. I'm looking around and it's not apparent, but there may be. I said yesterday as I was closing that I would begin with this one question just so that I didn't postpone it, and it's a legitimate question, and apparently one that there is interest in, and I got it in different forms. A couple of the forms I got it in, and I'm going to kind of blend these together. I think this came up in the first week when I was talking about how leaders handle out of control or difficult situations. And one of them simply said, how should we handle when a woman dominates a class with a male teacher teaching? Another one said, how do we handle elders or deacons' wives, their words, not mine, who can't keep their mouths shut? And so I kind of put that. They're two different questions, but they're very similar. I thought about this last night, so I'm going to go back and look at a couple of scriptures. I know many of you have been over these, but at least share with you my understanding of them, take a couple of minutes, and then we'll go back to some of the practicality of this. And as I said, it's kind of interesting because I got more questions about this from women than I did from men. And I didn't get questions about, well, why don't they teach? Why don't they preach? Why don't they lead songs? You may have those questions, but that wasn't what I was getting. I was getting more handling it when at least in their opinion, things were out of place. First passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verses 33 through 35 are the ones that are often looked at. Putting it in context, Paul has spent much of the time in chapters 12 and 14 talking about spiritual gifts, and apparently here at Corinth there was a little out of control situation. People were all speaking at the same time or trying to get preeminence because they had a certain gift and somebody else didn't. But in verse 33, he says, "For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. Let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for a woman to speak in the church." And this passage, along with another one or two, has led some to the conclusion that women should be silent, i.e. mute, during the worship service. I don't take 1 Corinthians 14 to mean that, and that should not be a newsflash. If I felt that, then I wouldn't be calling on any women who had a question or had a comment during class. I don't feel that way for a couple of reasons. Not because silence here doesn't mean be quiet, because I do think in this particular passage, silence does mean be quiet. The Greek word is sageo, however you choose to pronounce it, and as best I can tell, it literally means hold your peace, be quiet. Now I think this is an admonition here because there was some chaos in the church. I do not take this as a broad principle for us to apply to all applications because I don't think this particular command applied to all women. Because he tells them, be quiet, and then ask your husbands at home. Well, and I'm sure you've heard this argument, that has to exclude single people, and it would seem to me to have to exclude women whose husbands weren't Christians. So I tend to take this passage as an admonition for the brethren at Corinth because of the difficulties they were having, as opposed to a principle that I would be comfortable binding on all congregations in all ages. Now I want to be very careful because if we start looking at a passage and say, well, that applied to them and it doesn't apply to us, pretty soon we can open the floodgates and almost make nothing apply to us. But I don't particularly consider this one to apply. The other passage that I find more salient to our times is found in 1 Timothy chapter 2, and I will read verses 11 through 15. Let a woman learn in silence with all subjection, but I suffer not a woman to teach nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. For Adam was first formed, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression. Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing, if they continue in faith and charity and holiness and sobriety. But the passages or the verses that are most salient are verses 11 and 12, as I understand this issue. And it's interesting, I read it from the King James, so if you have the NIV, it may render it a little bit differently. I looked at multiple translations this morning, and most of them translated in verse 11, translated, let the woman learn in silence. But it is a different word than the one we find in 1 Corinthians 14, Greek, and it is a different Greek word than we're going to find in verse 12. So I've concluded that probably the King James translation in verse 11 is not the best translation. There the word is aletheis, and it means more to be true and unconcealed. I think probably verse 11 is really saying, let the woman learn in all truth. In other words, truth was not being withheld from the women. They needed to have it just as much as men. That makes sense to me. And the fact that a different word is used for there than we're going to see in verse 12 is further reasons that I feel that way. When we get to verse 12, the word that is translated silence in the King James, I suffer not a woman to teach nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence, is the Greek word hesia. And it carries, and I can see I misspelled quietness, but it carries the idea of gentleness, meekness. It does not carry, in my opinion, the idea of being mute for a couple of reasons. Number one, women are commanded to sing and to pray. Well, I don't know how you do that if you're mute. And secondly, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 12, this same Greek word is used. I said first. I meant 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 12. And them that are such, we command and exhort by our Lord Jesus Christ with quietness they work. In the King James, the word that's translated quietness there is this same word that in 1 Timothy 2 and 12 is translated silence. And I don't think there it means that when a woman works, she can't talk. That would be very, very difficult for most jobs. But it is this attitude of meekness. When I put all of that together, for me, probably the most defining verse in terms of these questions is verse 12, however. I do not believe a woman, it is wrong for a woman to speak. I do not believe, however, according to verse 12, that there should be a usurping of authority over a man. I suspect most of you would agree with what I just said. We may differ in the implementation of that and our comfortability with various areas of that. And I will entertain some discussion of this, but I don't want to spend the whole hour on it, because we could spend a whole week on this, because I know some of you will have different thoughts. Now back to the question. How should a leader handle it when a woman dominates a class with a male teacher? Well, I will say, if we have a class being taught by a man and a woman, even from her seat, tries to dominate that or lead it from her seat, I have to conclude that's inappropriate. You don't have to stand up. I think it would be inappropriate for the woman to stand up and be the leader, but you can lead from your seat. Now, having said that, every man here that is honest has made misstatements when he was teaching a class, and a kind sister has helped him get out of that hole. But to me, now we're talking about how important attitude is. And it can be done with attitude without the sense of dominance. The other question, how do you handle elders or deacons' wives who can't keep their mouth shut? But we could expand that. How do we handle anybody that can't keep their mouth shut? But as a leader of a congregation, ladies, I think it is even more, it's always appropriate, but it is even more essential for you to be able to handle things you hear with great discretion. Most leaders in a congregation know enough about various people in the flock to absolutely destroy them. And sometimes the wives of those leaders become knowledgeable about some of those things. Sometimes people come to those women because they are the wives of those leaders and they've earned respect. But many of the things that you hear need to be handled very, very discreetly, and probably a whole bunch of them should never go any further than you. There is a whole litany of things I do not tell my wife. It has nothing to do with trust. It's not fair for her to know some of these things, because then when she sees these people coming toward her, she's going to be thinking what I or someone else in my position is thinking, and I don't want her to do. I want her to enjoy everybody. And I don't mean by that I don't enjoy you, but sometimes when you know something, you see someone coming and you see a kind of a big problem walking at you, and you want to help. And I am very blessed with a wife that doesn't need to know everything. Some marriages are built around the concept that we share everything. Well, this is opinion, but I think I could put scripture with it if you asked me to. If you have a marriage where the husband and wife have to share everything, men, don't become leaders in the church in a formal sense, because it will eventually implode. It will eventually implode. Now, how do you handle this when it occurs? Well, now my wisdom's going to get just a little weaker, but hopefully my voice it won't. Delicately, for this reason, even if a man feels his wife is out of place, he will often get rather defensive of her if he feels somebody else is coming down on her. Having said that, one way of handling it would be to ask her husband to visit with her about it if she is married, and see if that can rein it in. That does not always work for a couple of reasons. Number one, she may not listen to her husband. And number two, her husband may not have the courage to do it. And I've seen both of those happen. Another way of approaching this is maybe having a sister in the congregation that she respects and that they have some chemistry discuss it. And I have seen that work, and it can be in a softer, non-confrontational way. Maybe the elders would ask the ladies, if they have a ladies' class, to include that as a general topic, hoping that this person will hear what's being said. It does not always work, but those are at least three ways which I would try first. If it just persists and is disruptive, or I've seen people leave congregations because of this, then I think an elder, that's when he has to be courageous enough and willing to do it, if those previous things or all other attempts have failed. I don't see this real often, personally, but I know of congregations where they have become very sensitized to it because of a few people. And once you get sensitized to it, every time you go, it's that burr under the saddle. You know, I'm there and then I'm gone, so the burr doesn't get too hard for me. But I would ask the ladies to be sensitive to this. I would feel like we would lose an awful lot if you didn't contribute like you do. But there is a sensitivity. But some people can get more sensitive to this than they ought to get, too. I was talking to a brother a few weeks ago, and he had gotten to the point, this bothered him, and he had gotten to the point where every Wednesday night he would count how many comments were made by women and how many comments were made by men. And if there were more comments by women than men, he would be upset. Well, that's probably not the way I would advise us to approach it. So, I am going to pause, and if I didn't answer those questions to your satisfaction, probe a little bit more, and I'll try to speak to them a little bit more. Maybe you've seen better ways to handle this. I think it's inappropriate for a man to dominate from the audience too, but for slightly different reasons. Now that's a topic that's just going to make everybody want to have a comment. I know it will. But Tom's here. Thank you, Tom.
I just wanted to go on what you said about the approach. It's really important. We have Paul writing to the Philippians in chapter 4. Two sisters apparently have a problem, and he beseeches them. He begs them. So the approach is really important, that you don't come across as an authoritarian. This is good for the congregation to consider.
That certainly should be our first several of tries. I had a lady at this meeting come up to me and try to share something with me that she had no business repeating. And I suggested to her that it would be best if we didn't repeat it and that it was gossip. And it just went clear over her head. So she was quiet for a few minutes, and then she came back and said, "I got proof." I said, "I don't care if you got proof, it's still not something that we ought to be talking about." She was wanting to tell me something about somebody else that I didn't need to know. I already knew it, but I didn't need to know it, and I didn't. What bothered me is how many other people had that been done. And this can happen to a man too. That's not a gender thing. We need to be very careful about what we say in terms of who needs to know it. Because we can character assassinate. You know, we don't call it gossip, we call it prayer requests. Well, there is a place for prayer requests, but don't use that term as a. There's a passage in Proverbs, and I didn't look it up. It just says these things they burn in our lips, and we can't wait to tell them. You know, the psychology of why we have to tell someone that something that they don't know yet. It's like it makes us feel more important. And I don't share that. I don't share that. Steve?
Your approach. That had a certain amount of indirectness to it, and I understand what you're saying. Putting it together with what Tom just said, perhaps you could say that's an indirect approach, but at the same time, he directed his comments to the party concerned. In other words, he told them, get together on this and resolve it.
Yeah, if you've got two people that are at loggerheads, Matthew chapter 18 says those two people ought to be the ones to get together. I was thinking more in terms of a public persistence in this. But having said that, I'm not against the direct approach. I just would go indirect first. But for a leader in the church, the good of the flock comes first, in my opinion. So if it's harming the flock, you may have to hurt a feeling. Sometimes they don't even realize it. And sometimes I've found they've done it for so long that it maybe doesn't occur to them, but indirect may not sink in. Barry?
I thought you had a very good answer, John. I recently was teaching from 1 Timothy 2, and I never had quite realized in 1 Timothy 2 and 2 that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life. The same word for quiet there is the same word that's used later in talking about the women. We have a quiet life, it doesn't mean you never talk to one.
Yeah. So 1 Timothy 2:2 would kind of go along with my 2 Thessalonians 3:12. Right. It's this attitude of peacefulness and meekness. Well, men ought to have that attitude too. But there is a little difference here in terms of the usurping of the authority that I think probably we need to be cognizant of. And I don't think you're not, but I was asked the question, and we need to address it. Charles, I hate to call on a woman now. No, I'm going to call on Kimber next. I'm just kidding, Charles.
Granted, some people just tend to dominate. Some women do need to speak up less, some men, but then there's also another side of that. Some people need to be a little quicker to contribute and participate, because sometimes people get in the habit of filling a void.
Yeah.
That others are unresponsive for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And if more of us were responsive, fewer people would dominate.
Yeah. When I came up here, I decided that we would have some discussion in QA. I knew that 10% of you would make 90% of the comments. And there's a bunch of you in that 90% that haven't said a thing I would love to hear from. But that's your choice. You might have noticed yesterday when I was going around, I would look for someone who hadn't yet had a chance to speak. Now, I'll call on you a second time, but there's just so much, such a plethora of wisdom here that I would just love to hear from some of you. But that's okay. But I would like to hear from Kimber now. That could be. That could be. Yeah, it's hard to know what's been said if we don't listen. That is true. Where are we at? Marvin? Is that who you said? Marvin?
If a woman usurps authority, if she's given a task by the elder to usurp.
His question is, does a woman usurp authority if she is given a task by the elders? I think she still could, because I think there are some tasks the elders have no right to delegate to her. Which wasn't exactly what you wanted me to say. I don't think the elder has the right to delegate to one of the sisters to teach the adult class. I don't think the elder has the right, biblically, to ask her to exhort the men in a public fashion. So, just because an elder asks a woman to do it, I don't think alleviates the concept of not being able to usurp authority, because there are some things elders don't have the right to ask certain people to do. Linda. Haven't heard from Linda. This is good.
Do you feel that there's a difference between, we have certain times that we meet, say 10 to 11 is Bible study, and then the women participate, mm-hmm. and sometimes our congregation is quiet, and the teacher will ask for a reader, and nobody speaks up. Mm-hmm. So when there goes that time, mm-hmm. that we could have in discussion or study or whatever, so quite often I'll raise my hand, and I've already read.
Okay.
That was one thing I wanted to comment on. And then the other one is, do you feel that there's a difference between the 11 o'clock service and the 12 o'clock service if the speaker is asking for a comment from the audience and he doesn't particularly say men only? Usually they don't. They'll say, I may call on you or this or that. Do you feel that that's a scriptural for a woman to read a scripture or answer the question that the speaker is...
After 11 o'clock?
After 11 o'clock. Well, you know, some people say this is...
I'm not being facetious. I just want to... Yeah, this is one of the arguments that you will find people making, and you'll find it in some of the commentaries of brothers that we hold and revere, that 11 to 12 is the worship service and 10 to 11 is the Bible study, and women can speak during a Bible study but not during the worship service. That, for me personally, has never worked. In practice, it works. I just don't see a big difference in our reverence to one another and usurping authority, whether it's the Bible study or the worship. But I don't have a problem with a woman if she is asked to do something like that. I think our classes tend to be a little less formal, so I think, and in general, we're more comfortable with it during that 10 to 11 period. And we'd probably be less likely to upset somebody. So I don't do it from 11 o'clock on. And you know what I mean when I say 11 o'clock on. I don't care what time you meet. But if, especially like on a Sunday night, sometimes it's more of a class than a sermon, and I think it's very open to that. One of you shared with me, and this was just last night, didn't happen anywhere close to here, But this was in a congregation that had a full-time preacher. He asked one of the ladies at the beginning of his sermon to get up and read a chapter. So she got up behind the pulpit and read a chapter, and it caused great consternation in the congregation. Well, this guy wasn't very sharp, because it happened to be the 1st of April. He gets up and says, "April fools," and they fired him that night, which they should have fired him before then. But it did have a different impact. And this woman thought that she didn't know he was going to do that, so it really hurt her, because he had used her in a very immature way. But I approach this, too, a little bit like Randy's talk Monday night on dress. It's not essential to do it, so why cause strife by doing it? But I go lots of places where they read around, or someone says, "Would someone read these verses?" And a lady will read those verses from her seat. I have no problem with that, if done in the proper attitude, and you would do it that way. I've had people ask me in real small churches where maybe there's only 2 men and 3 women, would it be okay, since the men are so overworked, for the woman to teach the class, as long as they sit around a table? I resisted giving an affirmative to that, because I don't know where you stop that. You can usurp the authority whether you're sitting or standing. Standing has some authority to it, but you can usurp the authority either way. So I have told them I wouldn't favor that. I don't know that they've always listened to me, but that's my feeling. Anybody else care to make a comment? Carla?
Would you just comment on in the home as opposed to a public worship?
Are we talking about a family Bible study?
Yeah, or a prayer. I always raised that a man always gave a prayer, until I visited some homes where the husband called on the wife to pray, even when there was company. Of course, I was a woman too, but I found that really interesting, because it surprised me, and I thought, why didn't I think of that?
I view the home setting to be different than the public assembly. You can still usurp the authority in a home setting, and we should never do that. Women should never do that, and men should never allow that. A lot of times women do this because there's a vacuum, so shame on us guys as much as the men, or as much as the women. We're the guys. But I call on my wife at home to offer prayers, and if we're having a home Bible study, I don't even really have a problem then. I would not be comfortable even in a home Bible study with men and women, with the woman being the primary teacher. To me, then you're back to usurping authority. But I do see a little more leeway there. Just like in a home, if we're learning a song and someone wants to go to Mike's keyboard that happens to be attached to a piano to help learn the song, to me that's different than having the piano in the worship service. And I suspect many of you listen to CDs that aren't all a cappella. I prefer a cappella because the harmony is almost always better. But I wouldn't want those in the assembly. I don't even like them being played in the church building, because that confuses visitors. But that's my opinion. Feel free, Joanne.
I've been trying to use
them. What about confession? I was recently in a church that women were not able to go forward to make confession. You had to write it down and don't just say it. The people in the congregation would think that person would be usurping authority.
Well, if the elders feel that way, I guess you've got to factor that in, but it's awful hard for me to figure out how someone who's coming and confessing and repenting is usurping authority. That ought to be the ultimate of humility before the Lord and before our fellow men. So I have never run into that. I believe you. I've just never run into that, but that would be quite foreign to my thinking. Would I respect the elders? No. Would I respect their wishes in a case like that, even though I disagreed? Well, if I was there, I guess I would, but I would disagree with the reasoning. A couple more, and then we'll move on. Janet?
Do you feel that assembly time on a typical Sunday morning is come to a point of tradition where a woman couldn't feel comfortable bringing a new song and teaching the group?
That has to be done on Sunday night. I don't personally think we're so as bound up in tradition as a lot of people think. And that may be because of my age. The younger we are, the more we tend to think we're in tradition, and the older we get, the less we call it tradition. We change it, and now we call it right. Well, let me make a couple of comments while I'm grabbing my thoughts. I don't think the Sunday morning service is a time to be learning a new song, no matter who's doing it. So I would disagree with that. And song leaders, Mike can get away with it, but he wouldn't do it on a Sunday morning. But he can teach us because his voice is strong enough. But that's not the time to be learning songs. I don't even really like learning songs in a worship service. I like having a time to learn songs. But that, when I'm trying to learn a song, I don't worship very well because I'm thinking about this kind of stuff Mike's teaching us this week, which is good. But when I'm worshiping, I want to be on autopilot for all that, and then I can focus on the words. If you're in a setting of song practice, the woman knows the song and nobody else, and her singing it can help the rest of us lead it or learn it, I don't have a problem with that. So much of it is attitude, though, and it ought to be under the direction of the elders or whoever they have designated. Follow up? Okay. Well, I don't know what time frame that was. Yeah, I understand. I think I take that as coming with a song you would like for us to sing, a psalm that you would like to have read. I never took that passage as a time when you taught me a new song. So I don't have any problem of Sunday night or whenever, but I don't like it on Sunday morning, but that's preference. Sunday night, maybe the song leader will say, you know, does anybody have a song we would like to sing? And the lady would like to sing, what is it, 243, whatever we've been singing. I don't have any problem with that, but that's not a leading and usurping of authority. That's bringing, I really like that song, I'd like for us to sing it. You're in a little different situation right now because you have a very small family-oriented group, which probably allows a little more leeway in that arena than some of the rest of us have. And you may not have been asking it in that context. I just feel, and there's a judgment here, anytime a woman takes a dominant, usurping position over any male, to me it contradicts, in the Christian assembly, it contradicts 1 Timothy 2:12. Period. Now, we can use judgment into when is it usurping the authority, and we're going to have different ideas on that, but that's the principle. And I don't know how to cover all the ideas and all the what ifs. Okay, anybody else want to make good? Now, it's an important subject, but let's go back. The questions weren't the woman's role in the assembly. I knew we'd get into that. The question was, when a woman is by the appearance and judgment of the congregation dominating or speaking when she shouldn't, how do you handle it? And I still prefer try the indirect, but if that doesn't work, don't let it persist. I had an elder tell me this week, we were talking about his congregation, he said, "You'd be the perfect guy to come and talk on that." Well, I'll come and talk on it, but it's not my responsibility to lead his congregation. It's his. And this is one area. Remember we talked about courage the first week? Well, this is courage to the nth power sometimes. Taking on a lady and her husband who probably will defend her, either because he feels that's his duty or he's scared of her. And it could be both. Notice my wife's not here. My wife would rather take a beating than make a comment in church. But that's just my wife. She doesn't think it's wrong. That's just my wife. And I'd rather take a beating than do some of the good things she does. So there we go. Okay. If you have more comments you'd like to ask me about that, we'll deal with that one-on-one, and if it seems to be something that we need to deal with that would be beneficial for the group, then I'll use my judgment there. Our subject is Christian leadership, and we do have some that haven't been able to be with us all of the time, so bear with me. I'm defining Christian leadership as influence. Certainly at times we will be talking about the roles of elders and deacons and evangelists, but I think all of us are leaders because all of us exert influence. You can be a bad leader, you can be a good leader, you can be a great leader. What you can't be is a non-leader, even though I and you would like not to be. Lots of times I wish people didn't watch what I do, but they do. They watch what you do. And we always are following somebody, whether it's a formal leader or not. What I want to spend time now in this segment is on the concept of confrontation. Not the most pleasant topic. And we really kind of segued into it just a little bit when I said, you know, if you have to confront someone in the subject we were just talking about, it can be difficult. In 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 5, Mark used this passage maybe yesterday. I can't remember, but he used it. And as I was reading it when he was had it up there, it struck me. I'm going to turn. 2 Peter 3 and 5. Now, he was using it in a different context because he was teaching a different subject. But in 2 Peter 3 and 5, it says, "For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water." And he used it from the concept of being willingly ignorant or ignoring the facts. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but that's my recollection. I think there's also an element here of fear to confront. I think sometimes we are willingly ignorant, not because we can't understand it, we just don't want to have to address it. It's the ostrich with his head in the sand. And I think that sometimes happens in families. I think it sometimes happens in congregations. Leaders must confront at times. And if your personality and your psyche will not allow you to do that, please do not become an elder or a deacon, because you will not be able to do some of the things God asks you to do. I will readily admit, sometimes elders and deacons are too confrontational, of course. They make mistakes. Scott Peck used a term in one of his books called pseudo-community. And what he meant by that was a place that is devoid of conflict. You ever had someone say, "Our congregation just doesn't have any conflict"? I don't believe them. I have never gone to any place that didn't have conflict. I have gone to a lot of places that ignored the conflict. I've never seen a family without some conflict. Now, usually when they mean that we're not having a civil war, nobody's leaving. But I'll ask an elders lots of times, "How's your congregation doing?" And they'll say, "Well, we have no conflict." And they're happy. That doesn't automatically make me happy. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, this is a rather long quote, "Nothing can be more cruel than leniency which abandons others to their sins. Nothing can be more compassionate than the severe reprimand which calls another Christian in one's community back from the path of sin." Now, is it good to have peace in our congregations? Yes. But not at the expense of not resolving conflict that ought to be resolved. Okay. And I think that's kind of what he was trying to get at. People often and usually respond defensively to a rebuke or a confrontation. And I use that example with the women speaking. The husband or she is probably going to get defensive, and they're not going to take it well. That's why that softer approach, if it will work, I like. Remember when John the Baptist talked about Herod Antipas and said, you don't have any right to be married to this woman. How did he take that? He didn't take it very well. He removed John's head. Rulers all throughout the Old Testament rejected the rebuke of the prophets. Think how different history would have been if they had listened to the rebukes of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah. Leaders must at times confront. But there is a very important distinction between being a godly reprover and being a jerk. Okay? There's a big difference between being a godly... I believe reproving in a godly manner is an art. And it's an art that many of us have not mastered. And I don't stand up here as someone who has mastered it. I will do pretty good occasionally, and then it seems like my patience wanes. Warren Wiersbe wrote, "Be kind, because everyone you meet is fighting a battle." And I think there is some truth to that. One of the reasons I think it is so hard for us to confront issues is because we would rather be comfortable than resolve it. And that causes us to ignore it if we can. Well, some issues maybe aren't worth a confrontation. But in the church and in our families, some are. And they must be resolved. I think a false desire for comfort is the reason many avoid conflict. So I've listed a few maybe reasons. Sometimes it's fear of the reaction. I'm afraid how they're going to react. I'm afraid what they're going to think. Well, if we're talking about something spiritual, what I have just said is, I value their feelings more than I value their soul. And that doesn't speak very well of me. If you love me, the most important thing for you to do to me is make sure I don't go to hell. And that may mean you have to tell me something I don't want to hear. Or vice versa. I think maybe some people just like to stay upset. They'd rather have the conflict boil under the surface rather than address it and move on. I think sometimes people avoid conflict in the church and in families because they want to feel as if they're unified. If the unity in your congregation has come about because you have avoided confrontations that needed to be resolved, that is false unity. And you should take no pride in it. I'm going to spend just a few minutes on Jonah. The book of Jonah, we do this in VBS, we study it many times. So we know the story. A man that was told to go to Nineveh. I'm going to read the first five verses of the book. Now the word of the Lord came unto Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness is come up before me." But Jonah rose up to flee into Tarshish from the presence of the Lord, and went down to Joppa, and he found the ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare thereof and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. But the Lord sent a great wind into the sea, and there was a mighty tempest in the sea, so that the ship was like to be broken. Then the mariners were afraid and cried every man to his God, and cast forth the wares that were in the ship into the sea to lighten it of them. But Jonah was gone down into the sides of the ship, and he lay and was fast asleep. You know that story very, very well. But I'd like for us to think of this story not so much as evangelism, although that is an important part of it, as Jonah preferring comfort rather than addressing conflict. Because I think that's the underlying thing throughout these four chapters. And when Jonah's decided to go to Tarshish, what was he doing? He was moving away from a confrontation rather than addressing it and resolving it. It's exactly what I think was occurring. Jonah was looking for an easier way out and avoiding confrontation and doing things that are hard in the short term is viewed as an easier way out. So, okay, I'll go to Tarshish. But unresolved conflict generates more conflict. In our homes and in our congregations, every problem we don't resolve that needs to be resolved is going to result in 2, 3, 4, or 10 more problems down the road, I can guarantee you. I was talking to an elder, oh, it's been a year or so ago, a particular problem arose in their church. And he said, we need to address it. But then with his next breath, he said, but if we address that, we've got 9 other situations just like it, and half the congregation's going to leave. Now, what had happened? They had not addressed the issue in the first 9, so now they're up here, and it just kept growing and growing and growing. Charles touched a little bit about marriage, divorce, and so forth. I'm not on that subject, but that and other subjects, it's not just for the good of the sinful person. It's not just for the good of the leaders. All these eyes are watching what we do. Our young people are learning what we really believe by how we do and don't act as much, if not more, by what we do and don't say. Don't teach the young people that something is wrong and then don't address it within the congregation and the family, unless you want an absolute disaster. In the case of Jonah, I think there are multiple conflicts. The first conflict didn't even deal with Jonah. The first conflict was God had a problem with Nineveh. That's a conflict. He wanted to resolve it. Enter Jonah. But now Jonah has a conflict with God. I don't want to do it. Now we find in verse 5, it grew into now Jonah's got a conflict with the people on the ship. See? When conflicts aren't addressed, it just spirals out of control. And that's exactly what I find happening here in these first 5 verses of the book of Jonah. Now, you know the story. What was Jonah's solution? Throw me in the sea. What else could Jonah have said to solve this problem? Turn the ship around and let's go back. That's exactly right, Eldon. Jonah could have said, turn the ship around. Now, why don't you think Jonah said, turn the ship around? Still didn't want to face him. Okay. Said another way, I think Jonah would rather die than face that conflict. That is how much people, that is the lengths to which people will go to avoid conflict. Now, my intellect says, well, turn this ship around, anything's better than dying. That's not true as a Christian, but... Got it? Okay. But it's interesting. Here's a man who would rather die than address the conflict. Amazing. Well, let's don't wag our finger too much at Jonah, because we got a little Jonah in us, don't we, sometimes? The conflict does not go away with time. But once we learn to resolve conflict, it can bring about growth. And I'm almost believing that without resolving it, there can't be growth. Not the kind that God is looking for. Conflict is such a key to this story. If this was just an evangelistic story, Jonah, you go evangelize Nineveh, the book of Jonah would end at the end of chapter 3, because he'd done it. But you get to chapter 4, we've got that whole gourd story. What's going on? Jonah and God Jonah still has conflict with God. It has not been resolved. Now, he's resolved the mission, the task, but not the conflict. And that was the underlying conflict, Jonah and God. Leaders need to say, I hope I got this on there. Yes, good. Leaders, whether it's an office or just you in your sphere of influence, as a Christian leader, you must say and do whatever needs to be said and done. If you don't, you're not a leader. Now, sometimes we say some things that shouldn't be said, and we do things that shouldn't be done. But you cannot be a Christian leader if you are not willing to say whatever needs to be said and done, and that will often not be comfortable. Period. But I believe true unity can only occur after appropriate conflict is resolved. And leaders have to lead the way, sometimes through or with conflict. I didn't put this on because it's a rather long quote, but I want to read it to you. God's reproofs are in love, and so should be ours. Holy reproofs in the spirit of affection are sniffers of gold. Never use any other, and even use these with discretion, lest you put out the flame, which it is your aim to improve. In other words, don't quench that spirit so much that they can't come back, but sometimes you have to reprove. Never reprove in anger, it says. Do not deal with a small fault as if it were a big crime. If you see a fly on your child's forehead, do not kill it with a sledgehammer, or you will kill the child. Do the needful, but very difficult work of reproof in the kindest and wisest style, so that the good you aim at may be attained. That was Charles Spurgeon. I don't agree with his theology, but I thought he was right. Using prayerful wisdom and prayerful judgment in this area, but leaders, and again, I'm not just talking about our elders, because confrontation and dealing, it should be dealt at the lowest level. Matthew chapter 18. Got an ought with your brother? You go to him one-on-one. If that doesn't work, then you may have to get more people involved. But confrontation. Matthew chapter 5, don't bring your gift to the altar if you have aught against your brother. Translated in this context, don't come and worship God if you've got unresolved conflict with somebody in the brotherhood that you have not resolved. Now, maybe you can't resolve it, but try. You ever come to church mad at somebody? It's awful hard to worship. I have. Or upset. Maybe mad. No, mad's the right word. I've come upset, but I've come kind of mad. And what do? You think about that during the worship service. And they may be sitting on the other side of the pew. Well, your mind's not focused on the Lord like the Lord deserves, is it? That's unacceptable worship. We heard a little bit about that Sunday morning. Okay, I think that's all I had on that. Yeah. I'm going to pause and see if anybody has a comment or a question you would like to make about that. We shouldn't go looking for conflict. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that we can't hide from it, because human beings have it, and it has to be dealt with. Anybody care to make a comment or ask a question? Dean.
I just wanted to second the motion that, yeah, you have to resolve conflict.
Yeah. I was dealing with a couple some time ago, and they left a congregation, and one of the reasons they gave for leaving it was they had never seen any confrontation dealt with in that congregation for the last 15 years of which they were members. And I don't know if there was any conflict during 15 years. It's just hard for me to imagine there couldn't have been. There had to be some conflict. I have conflict with myself more than that. Before you even mix in other people. So, has to be dealt with, I think. Yeah?
What do you consider conflict? Are you considering conflict something that's just interrupting?
Okay. I'm using it fairly broadly. It could be a sin that's causing a conflict within the congregation, but it could just be two of us not getting along because of a personality clash. Now, we may never get along if it's a personality clash, but we ought to resolve it to the extent that it's not our primary focus when we see each other. I considered Paul with John Mark and Barnabas. That was a conflict. I don't think it was doctrinal. I think all three men were Christians, but there was a conflict. Well, they resolved it sort of by just going their separate ways, but they ultimately had, I think, were better for having resolved it, because then Paul later says, well, John Mark, come right along, and maybe I was wrong. I'm paraphrasing. But that wasn't a doctrinal thing. I don't know that it was a sin issue. It just was hindering the work. So that needs to be dealt with. So it could be either one. I'm using it fairly broadly. Now, you would handle them differently. There, with sin, there might need to be church discipline and various things. But with conflicts of whatever, I still think they need to be resolved. I don't want to get into war stories. It's just amazing some of the things people get upset about and quit coming to church. Our little country congregation, this is before I was even born. No, before I was involved with it. They tell me the story. In the parking lot, one of the members backed up and dented a fender. And they got into a fist fight over it and never resolved it. Now, is that an egregious example that I hope nobody here would even get close to doing? And I'll check my car and make sure. But, you know, it is amazing. Well, that should never happen. I mean, backing into it, that can happen, but it should be resolved. But it can be over silly things. Like, I had one brother mad at another brother because that brother never called on him to offer prayer during the public service. I mean, you know, get a life. But if he was doing that intentionally, and he probably was in this case, they should resolve that conflict. Resolve it. So I was using it in both ways. Because I think both of them can be salvational issues. Even if it's not a sin to start with, not resolving that conflict could be wrong. Could be a sin. Follow up. You don't care what my car looks like? I'm afraid you do. I'll be parking at the square. Go ahead. Okay. He said, in one way, it's no business what he said neighbors, but I'm going to say brothers and sisters are doing. But if they're sinning, should he take that to the elders, or should he address it? Well, number one, I think it is your business what we are doing, because we are to look after one another. Now, we're not to be moral traffic cops and drive by each other's houses to see what's going on. But if you or I see a bro, if you see me sinning, you owe it to come and talk to me. And step number one is come and talk to me, and not talk to Doug about it, or Becky about it, or Steve about it. Now, if you and I can't get it resolved, and I don't thank you for coming and change, then you may have to bring... It's that progression we find in Matthew chapter 18. But it is your business. You want to talk about helping your elders, don't expect them to have to do what you ought to be doing. And this is the classic example. Well, the elders haven't addressed it, so I guess it's not important, so I'll stay out of it. If it's against what ought to be done, it's your... And I think we'll be accountable for it if we don't. Do I wish it weren't like that? Lots of times I do. I would just like to dump it all at the elders' feet. But I don't. That's not biblical. Do they have a responsibility and an accountability? Absolutely. I think I shared with you the first week, and he's sitting in the audience, but I asked an elder how to handle situations. The very first thing out of his mouth was, teach them how not to expect the elders to do what they ought to be doing. And this is a classic example of it. Class, or evangelists, or deacons, whatever. They're there to help us, but not to do what we ought to be doing. If we use them that way, then we're kind of not in the mutual ministry business in a practical way. Because we're having someone do the ministry, not the preaching, but we're having somebody ministering where we ought to be ministering. Dan.
Kind of along that line, several things that I have noticed is sometimes the elders are involved in the situation and nobody thinks it's going on because it's a private situation and there is something going on. And so being a little understanding sometimes is helpful.
Yeah.
But the second thing that comes with that, I've also noticed that sometimes elders are the last to know. And it's helpful.
And,
you know, if you're taking care of it, that's fine, but don't spread it around and then come back later.
Yeah, sometimes elders being the last to know is good and sometimes it's bad. So I understand what you're saying. Yeah, and let's say Mark sees me doing something and it just continues. I don't think it's wrong for Mark to go to my elders, or let's put us in the same congregation because that makes it easier, and say, you know, I've got a concern about something and I'm going to have to go talk to him about it, but I don't want to get the cart before the horse. Are you dealing with it or should I? But he can't go. I wouldn't want him to go and say, well, you guys take care of it. Now, sometimes the elders can't say what they're doing, but if they're aware of it and something's going on, because you do hear this a lot sometimes, well, the elders aren't doing anything. And that is often true, but is also often not true. So a little communication there. I don't think it's wrong at a business meeting or some forum for the elders to say, we're working on this situation without getting into details so the congregation knows that. But yet, we have individual responsibilities. And Dan's not saying that we don't. Tom.
Could you clarify that, John? If an example is Mark saw you doing something, wouldn't you rather he come to you first before he goes to your elders?
Usually. Yeah. I would always rather him come to me first. The elders might not want him to mess something up they're working on. So you've got to use a little judgment there. Lewis.
Concerning personal offense, it seems to me one of the things that I know the Bible teaches us to be long-suffering. And it seems like one of the things that you have to do is to determine, is this something I should be long-suffering? Is it something I should overlook? And if we arrive at that conclusion, then we should. We keep on spinning over again and again, allowing it to boil, that we're not being long-suffering. We're not being charitable. Now, on the other hand, if it is something that we've determined that it is an offense that we can't overlook, that it's going to be like a thorn in our side, then it's time to confront. So I don't think every conflict doesn't have to be just because an offense occurs. Many things we can conscientiously overlook, we can put aside, and it's not being neglectful or being irresponsible. It's observing this is a small matter. If we picked every small matter that bothers, where would we be?
Probably about where we're at. Could you hear him? Good. Because that was, I wouldn't do it justice. Yeah, for the tape, his basic comment is there are sometimes things that just we should overlook and they're not worthy of being resolved. And that's often many cases, but my point is, even if I should overlook it, if I'm having trouble overlooking and it's causing me to stew, I need to talk to whoever it is for my good to get it off my chest so that I'm not focused on that. So even if I should overlook it, and many times I should, maybe we need to have a little dialogue in order to help us get over that hurdle. Because things can bother us. You know, in Matthew 5, if you have aught against your brother, I don't think that's necessarily a sin. It's just something sticking in your craw. It would include sin, but something sticking in your craw that keeps you from being able to focus on the Lord when you come together. But yeah, you know, we all ought to have thicker skin and softer hearts. We tend to have thin skin and thick hearts. and that's backwards to what we ought to have. Anybody who hasn't had a chance yet? You had a chance. Well, only one. Who's counting? You had a chance. You haven't?
Okay.
Okay, go.
Many of the comments that have been made remind me of passages where God used the word peacemakers. That's an active word, not a passive word.
Yeah. Yeah, and obviously in the context that Christ uses us, we should be peacemakers. But in the context we use it often, we shouldn't be. Because we'll often use it as peace at any cost. And there are prices that are too high to pay for. Another question that I came up, and I'll get to you, Becky. Maybe we'll touch on this a little bit tomorrow. What do you do in a congregation where there is sin, but the elders haven't, at least to your knowledge, done anything about it? And it's persisted for months, if not years. What does a member do? And we won't start with that tomorrow, but maybe I can get to that tomorrow. Becky? Yeah. Always get the facts the best you can. Now, my parting comment is, we've been talking about us confronting somebody else. We need to be very, very wise and thankful when people have enough courage to confront us when we need to be confronted. We're always thinking about we're the strong helping the weak. Well, lots of times we're the weak that needs to be helped. And if we have a defensive attitude, we may have cut the legs out from someone that we need very, very badly to be there to help us time and time again. If somebody loves you enough to come and address an issue with you rather than burying it, you are blessed to have someone who loves you enough to do that and cherish them. Because friends like that are few and far between, even in the church. Take your break.